Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm Mayhem.
Hello, I'm Chaos.
And our happiness is egg-shaped.
Happiness is egg-shaped. It loves a circle with no end.
Happiness is egg-shaped.
Happiness is egg-shaped.
Happiness is egg-shaped and loves a circle with no end.
Hello and welcome to the Happiness Is podcast with me, Bruce Aitchison, your host from Happiness Is Egg-Shaped. And today we have another magnificent guest, and I am silly happy and silly smiling because this is one of the coolest guests we could possibly secure. Absolutely delighted. As soon as I asked him, he jumped in and said, yeah, sweet as, we're in. And not only is this a cool guest, this is somebody who is on the other side of the planet, currently enjoying some sunshine and no lockdown restrictions at the moment. So a bit of jealousy in my voice as well. This is a guy who has come right into the forefront of everybody's consciousness in World Rugby. I reckon he is probably one of the most recognizable faces and names in the game at the moment because of all the good stuff he is doing. He is a man who has rugby and its people in his heart, and he is doing his damnedest to make sure that everybody gets a fair crack. And I am very, very excited to speak to somebody who has a whole bundle of caps for Samoa. He's played for what must be one of the most exciting invitational combination teams on the planet, the Pacific Islanders. He has been to World Cups. He's played in the Premiership. He's played in France. He's in Aussie. Please welcome our very special guest, Mr. Dan Leo.
Hey guys, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. As you say, Bruce, can't complain being on the side of the world at the moment. No masks, no social distancing. The only thing is we can't hang out and see all of you guys and on that side of the planet. So let's hope things improve pretty drastically and pretty quickly.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. Well, life looks good. So you're in Brisbane, which is that now home?
For the foreseeable future, we did the first lockdown. My family and I have got two young boys, a five-year-old and a two-year-old. We did the first lockdown, which was 3 months of homeschooling for me mid last year, and that basically pushed me to breaking point, to the point where I thought, no flipping heck, where else do I qualify to live that's a bit more normal? So we came back, been back here for 6 months. I've been working full-time in the disability sector. A friend of mine was good enough to give me a job working with people with special needs, which has been definitely thrown up its challenges. But and the plan is that we stay here for the next 6 months at least, and hopefully, as I said, when things return back to normal and kids can run around freely again, we can head back up.
I bet you are awesome at that job. That just what I mean, people all over the world must look at you and think, right, he's pretty cool, but I bet you are awesome at that job. You must get a huge amount of satisfaction from that.
It's a lot easier than homeschooling, that's for sure, so I'm thankful for that. You're right, in terms of coming from rugby, and this is one of the things that I challenge the players that the ex-players that I work with is, using those transferable skills that we sometimes don't appreciate that we've got, and working in a team alongside people that maybe others don't have the opportunities that we do as fully able people has been a massive honour to be able to do that. And actually just the mindset of some of these people in the face of resilience has really challenged me to be the best version of myself as well. So and I'm really enjoying it, and it's not something I say that I plan to fall into, but in these times you don't get to necessarily choose what you've just got to take the opportunities that are in front of you. And that was an opportunity, as I said, a friend of mine that I'd lived with when I was back in the Queensland Reds Academy back in 2002, I think it was. He'd moved on after professional rugby and started up this company that I worked for called Carers Collective. And he was good enough to give me take a risk on me with no experience at all in the sector and give me a job. So, I'm learning a lot on the go, but still got a lot to learn.
Yeah, and I bet it makes you feel very grateful.
It does, particularly, we've just taken on a few new clients who are spinal victims, victims of rugby injuries themselves. And, speaking to these guys who are young guys who will never, in some cases, never walk again, never breathe on their own, never be able to, shower themselves on their own. It makes you realize how lucky we, myself, yourself, Bruce, any of us that have played the game of rugby actually are to come out the other end unblemished. It does make you think about all of those times when you could have got injured, when you did get injured, and it could have been a lot worse. So working with these guys now is a pleasure now, and as I said, I'm really blessed to be able to do it.
I just love it. Dan, I love your outlook. I love how you go about things. So let's rewind that then right back to those Queensland days. So you left New Zealand to head to Aussie for uni. Is that a big jump, or is it just how things are? Did you see that as a big event in life?
My parents moved across as well, so I was just finished high school, and mum and dad moved across. Mum and dad were missionaries, and they decided to retire as missionaries when I was in my high school and get jobs, and the only jobs that they could find were across in Australia. So they gave me the opportunity. They gave me the choice, basically. My stepbrother stayed in New Zealand. They said, look, you can stay with him or you can come across with us, but before you make the choice, come across and have a look. And I got here and it was just, chalk and cheese, really. So, the sun was out,
Yeah.
The girls loved us Maori and Pacific Islanders. So, mate, I was just like, that was sold for me before I even barely stepped off the plane. So,
we're pretty simple creatures, aren't we? We're pretty simple creatures. Yeah. We know. So life for you has moved a lot. You're a Palmy North boy, or born in Palmerston North, certainly, and then head to Auckland for school. So you've always jumped into different circles, never mind the different teams and countries you've been to for rugby. So your social skills are obviously finely tuned, and you enjoy building relationships with other people.
Yeah, I was really lucky. Even before rugby came, I've moved a lot. I've lived in as I said, New Zealand, Australia, the islands. I spent, mum and dad did a year's missionary training in Tonga. So I lived in Tonga, even though I'm Samoan, learned a bit of the language and a bit of the culture there. In my rugby career, it's taken me to England and France. I played for London Welsh. I won't claim the Welsh card, learning of people as well. And in the missionary lifestyle as well, the missionary school that my parents used to run, you know, we had people from Denmark, from Norway, from the United States, a lot of places that were non-rugby playing nations that I got to, you know, make friends with well, as well, and actually relate to. So all of this boded well for my, I suppose, for my rugby career, yes, but for, you know, more so for the stuff that I'm doing now, the advocacy stuff and working with players and actually being able to relate to anyone from any walk of life is a skill that I've been lucky enough to pick up along the way. It wasn't planned, I was lucky enough to, through circumstance, to have some pretty cool experiences growing up, including going to school at Auckland Grammar, as you mentioned, and living in Auckland, which is, we like to say, you know, think of ourselves as one of the most multicultural countries and cities in the world. In terms of Polynesians, yes, and again, that's put me in good stead for working with Pacific Island players and players of descent in the role that I do now.
I can imagine you, Dan, being reasonably comfortable in almost any social circle. You can speak to paupers and princes, no doubt, and you've had to, with this role that you've got, you're speaking to shirt and ties behind desks, but you're also going out and speaking to people who are almost your peers. You're a role model to those younger than you. What's the role that you relish the most? What's the role that you think you get the biggest kick out of?
That hasn't always been the case. I, like many Pacific Islanders, when I first arrived in the UK as a 23-year-old, I was very shy, very reserved, I wasn't outspoken at all. You know, it was just all about, you know, toeing the line and, respect for elders, because that's the way I've been raised. It wasn't actually until, you know, and I'm gonna blame you Brits, for this, particularly the English, because I married an English girl, Sarah, my wife, and I vividly remember sitting around a dinner table with a few of her uni friends, and in my background, the way that I've been raised is that when you're meeting new people, you don't say a lot. You're seen, and you know, if somebody asks you a question, you answer, but you're not the one making conversation. And I remember getting home that evening and Sarah looking at me and just going, why were you so weird? Why were you so, despondent with everyone at the table, you know? And for me, that was my way of showing respect. I was like, no, I just didn't want to overwhelming for people. I just, you know, but for her, it had come across as rude. So automatically for me, I learned at that stage, okay, well, that's, you know, I need to change, that hadn't been something that I was really used to. But all those sorts of circumstances are what, you know, what life throws at us. And I learned from that, and I thought, okay, well, that's you know, I'm in England now. I'm not back in South Auckland. I'm not in Brisbane in the Samoan community in Brisbane. I'm in, you know, and you're expected to make conversation, and that's a sign of respect when you're open, and when you're friendly. And that was very different to anything that I'd really experienced up until that point. So, So I've got my wife to thank a lot for the way that I've developed, and also just challenging me on not accepting the status quo, which is, I'm sure we'll get into this, Bruce, a little bit further down the track. For us, it's, you know, we don't rock the boat as Pacific Islands. It's just, you know, it's all very, you know, and we come across as very laid back people, which is possibly why, you know, we're in the positions in terms of rugby that we are. I've gone off.
So that's a cultural bit, and we will definitely get to that, because I've played in different places and almost always come across a Pacific Islander. I've also almost always come across another bloody Scotsman because we tend to get everywhere as well. And I don't know what that says about our home countries, but we can maybe talk about that another time too. But these cultural things are really important, but they can be small details. And I'll give you a funny one that a friend of mine, Ben Fisher, who's a Kiwi from Wellington, came across to Scotland, was here for years and years. He's now back working for New Zealand Rugby Union. And he married a girl from Edinburgh, and his son, Matthew, had his first 6 years in Edinburgh. He's now back in New Zealand. And Ben and I were messaging recently, and he was saying he's now a proper Kiwi. He just went to the supermarket without any shoes on. which I thought was hilarious, because when I went across when I was 19, and I remember going to the supermarket with Reese, my mate, and there was all these people around in the supermarket without any shoes on. I was like, what the hell? Like, that, my mother would kill me if I did that here. But there's all these little bits. I remember having a Fijian player in a club I coached in Edinburgh. There's a huge Fijian community here, largely because of the army. And this saps, I'll never forget, he went to give this offload and it went to ground and we turned it over. And the coach, my assistant coach, was a guy, Matt, who was also in the army and had worked with heaps of Fijians. And he said, look, you got to understand, that's the way he is. That offload makes perfect sense to him. So you got to take the times it doesn't come off with the times it does come off. And I've always loved, possibly like you, the different cultures and meeting people, but maybe more on the front foot than you're saying you initially were. What is it that you think rugby, let's look at the positives. What is it that you think rugby has done well for the Pacific Islanders?
Geez, so much, you know. We're cultures that are basically, you know, pride ourselves on three things: family, church, and rugby. Those are probably in that order. It brings so much to the islands. Anyone that's been to the Pacific Islands, you know, just has to look around, and it's you know, in the lack of televisions and PlayStations and social clubs and pubs, that's what you do. You know, every village has got a rugby field. And you know, it brings people together, and so that's it's something that you can't put a monetary value on. And you know, it's just a great sport, great for us. You know, our physiques and probably our ancestry probably fit into the sport quite well. You know, the combative nature that we've got, but also that camaraderie. You know, that's world renowned. You know, and I think that's the great thing about rugby, is that you can go to, you know, you can be off a tiny little island in the, you know, in the outer islands of Tonga, and you can land up, you know, end up in a pub in Edinburgh, and you can have a two-hour conversation with somebody over a few pints, because you've got this great, you know, commonality of rugby. And what else can bring people together like that, you know? And vice versa, you know, you Scots can come out to the Pacific, and we might not know anything about you, but if you know anything about rugby, that's, you know, we'll, you know, you might as well have played for the Scottish national team, or be in the royal family, because that's the way you'll get treated. So and you know, it's on another level. You know, and what I guess it brings to the our countries is a great sense of pride, because we are very good at rugby, and we have historically been good at rugby, and also a lot of you know, all everything that comes with that, you know, the opportunities for our players to go and make a living overseas and send money and remittances home to support the villages and the families. It's beneficial on so many levels, Bruce.
So those three things, family, church, and rugby, they're done with others, with strong relationships. They bring people together for a purpose, whether that is to share a meal or to share a prayer or to share in a game of rugby. They bring people together. So the community is important to Pacific Islanders, as it should be to everyone, but certainly to the Pacific Islanders. So is that the biggest challenge you see for when Pacific Islanders leave that environment and go overseas to a professional contract? Is that the biggest challenge? It's that feeling of community and security and then going into an unknown?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's our biggest blessing and our biggest curse, because you know the way that the rugby world is, the economies of the rugby world operate now, is all the money's in Europe and Japan, you know, for our players, because it's very difficult to pick up contracts in Australia and New Zealand unless you've resided there. So the players have to, you know, basically move halfway around the world, which is, yeah, can be really tough, away from their social support bases, away from their traditional, the village, the church, as I mentioned, a big one, and their families. So it can be really, really tough. I experienced it in probably a lesser sense, because those of us that have been raised in New Zealand and Australia, it's probably a little bit easier. But even myself moving to France and having to adjust to a new language, a new culture, even that was difficult for me. And you know, my wife is English and she speaks French, and it was still hard, you know. So it did give me that window of insight, but also just the fact that our cultures are so submissive and subvert. I'm not going to try and use that word, because but basically. We're not used to reaching out for help when we need it, is quite a part of it. And that's maybe not just our culture, probably lots of cultures are like that, but it can be really, really tough when you don't speak the language as your first language as well. So we've got a lot of challenges, Bruce.
And that's the guys I know from the Pacific Islanders, and over my shoulder I've got a signed shirt from Bill Mata, who's here in Edinburgh, and you know, seems happy. But there's a huge Fijian community, yeah, in Edinburgh, largely because of the army, and then quite a lot of the Fijian soldiers hang around and make life here, because this is where they go. My best mate, who's also in the picture back here, Rupeni, he's gone back to Fiji and has taken skills and has taken money and wants to go back and make Fiji a better place. And while I miss him, I'm looking forward that hopefully one day I'll get to go and see him and see what it's like in his culture, because he's been here and been in mine. How many of the players leave thinking, that's me, I'll never be back? Is it a bit like the streets are paved with gold and I won't be back? Or do you feel like there's a lot of them do want to come back and contribute or give back?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And again, it's we tend to bandy the Pacific Islands together because of our proximity to each other. You know, a flight from Tonga to Samoa or to Fiji is only, we're only an hour flight away from each other. But there's a lot of similarities, a lot of differences as well. Fiji is a much bigger place than Tonga and Samoa. And they seem to be a lot more drawn to moving home at the end of their careers, the players, in my experience. But then on that front, there's a lot more for them to take their families back to. You know, Fiji is a country of a million people now. There's a strong tourism sector. Well, before pre-COVID, there was a lot more industry. Some really good schools there. So a lot of the Fijians that go back, the Fijians that I meet are a lot more, you know, that's their focus. They want to earn good money and go back. Whereas with the Samoans and Tongans, it can be very different. Most of the Samoans and Tongans that I work with, their plan is to save enough money and invest wisely enough so that they don't ever have to go back to Samoa or Tonga.
Okay.
Because yeah, they're such small places, particularly those that have made a life overseas and have raised their children in a Western culture. I'll use an example. You know, Henry Tuilangi, who's a very good friend of mine, he's got seven kids. Now they've all been basically raised in France for his I think he had an 18-year career or something like that, and Leicester, and then France. So they're basically European, you know, and they're all fluent in French. They've done most of their schooling there. So for all, you know, domestic purposes, they're French, you know, and to move back to an island like Samoa, particularly where their family is in Savai'i, which isn't even the big island. It's a lot more laid back, a lot less resources than the main island, would be really, really difficult for the kids. So he's decided to, you know, to try and stay in France, you know, even to probably to his detriment, probably against what his heart's, you know, the callings, the pulls. You know, if you've been raised in those islands, you always want to go back. It's the same as my father. You know, always his biggest dream is that me and my sisters, we buy a commune back in Samoa and take our wives and husbands and we all live there. It's never going to happen, but that's he likes to hold on to that dream. So it can be difficult when you realize that dream's never probably going to be a reality. But those are some of the challenges. It's just there's such a small place. You know, Tonga again is 100,000 people. There's not much going on in Tonga. So if you've got kids who are university educated, it's, you know, to take them back there, to limited opportunities is going to be very difficult.
I think people sometimes forget how small Tonga and Samoa because you're massively overrepresented. You produce a ridiculous number of players in, and there's not really another industry where the Pacific Islanders are so front and center, is there? I mean, rugby is number or league and union, but so front and center. There's very few others that highlight it so much, and that is obviously a great strength, but it's taken away a lot of the human resource from the country. When you left to go to Europe, what was going through your head? How big a challenge was that for you as an individual?
Yeah, you've touched on a couple of important topics there, Bruce. I think you know, not only do we have the rugby agents and scouts and schools coming now to the Pacific Islands, you know, looking for talent, for, you know, offering scholarships, etc. We've got rugby league, we've got the NFL now. They ran their first professional scouting camp in Apia last year. Traditionally, they've only stuck to American Samoa, and you know, Pacific Islanders, even from that tiny population of American Samoa is only 20,000 people. Pacific Islanders in the NFL are the per capita the most represented people group in the NFL. Wow. That's just based on, you know, a few American Samoans and the Mormon population that have moved from Tonga and Samoa to the state of Utah. That's where they pick up all these players. So they've come. They're on our shores now. So the sharks are circling. So it's really important that we look into the pathways, that we get this right, that we, you know, if we want to continue being rugby playing nations, that we see the investment that's needed there. For me, as a young player coming to Europe, probably none of that was really on my radar when I first arrived. You know, I knew I always wanted to play for Samoa. I was never good enough, probably, you know, admittedly, to be an All Black. So that rule that one out for me pretty early on. And playing for Samoa gave me that opportunity to get that international test, which was required for me to come to WASPs, because to get the working visa, you had to have played internationally. So I was very lucky to be able to qualify for Samoa, and then come and make a livelihood out of rugby over in the UK and France. So it wasn't massively on my radar, any of this sort of stuff. This, you know, the politics and the, you know, the,
I don't think that's on anyone's radar.
you know, the I guess you could say the exploitation wasn't something that I came into knowledge of until much later on in my career.
Who's the biggest job, or what is the biggest job for education of rugby players? Is it the player? Is it the kid? Or is it the parents and the village?
Geez, I'd say the agents. For me, the missing link in the whole situation is the agents, because the agents are the first port of call that players will go to. And for us as Pacific Islanders, you know, and my dad, he only went up to, I think he did 2 years of primary school, and then he left school, so he never felt equipped to be able to, you know, help me with anything on the contract front. So a lot of our Pacific Island parents are in the same boat. A lot of them left school to go and work to provide, you know, and that's the same for the ones that, you know, even the parents that are living in New Zealand and Australia. You know, a lot of them, you know, hold down two jobs to make ends meet. You know, low skilled labor. That's what, you know, there's a massive drove of Pacific Islanders that came across to Australia and New Zealand as they were industrializing in the early 80s, late 70s. So that's so our parents can't really help us, and that's what's difficult, you know. That's what I've really come to realize when a lot of the players that I play with in the UK, in Scotland, Wales, England, Ireland, you know, it's basically it's a private school sport. Yep. So and even though that's starting to change, a lot of the teammates that I had when I was playing at Wasps and London Irish were from backgrounds where they really appreciated education, and their parents were there to be helpful in that process. Their parents were the ones that were driving that for them, you know, and that was, yeah, so that's something that's probably missing for us as Pacific Islanders. So that's where those of us that are, you know, probably at the end of our careers now and a bit more retired need to go back and give back and actually help this next generation to come through and learn off the mistakes that we did. But I think, yeah, to go back what I was saying, you know, I think the agents a lot of the time are, probably don't even realize, don't have that recognition themselves. So I've sort of earmarked that as a really important part of the work I'm doing now, is really to help educate the agents, because our parents, our players, you know, they just trust everything from, you know, contracts to the finance, looking after our finances, and so it's really important that you get that the right agent, and then B, if, you know, I mean, there's good agents and bad agents out there. In my experience, no one sets out to be a bad agent. No one sets out to say, I'm going to take advantage of this young kid from the islands. They all come out saying that they, you know, I think everyone's got, you know, and maybe I'm looking with rose-tinted glass here, but in my opinion, most people are good people. I like to see the good people. And most people want to do the right thing, but it's just having the resources to, and the knowledge and the expertise to be able to help those people. And that's where possibly, you know, the work that I'm doing now, we can fill that gap.
Yeah, I love that. And Dan, I can see that you see the good in people. Anybody who's watched the movie, and I think everybody has now, anybody who has got anywhere close to rugby has watched Oceans Apart and seen how you conducted yourself in that. And I think some of us were probably sitting on the couch saying, Dan, just have a go at him. Just tell him what you really do. But you were so polite, and you were hoping that they were doing things with the best of intentions. When you talk like that, it makes me think, I was having this conversation with somebody the other day about football in this country and footballers, the sweeping statement, but came from working class backgrounds. They, you know, football was their thing, and that was their way to then getting the glory and the riches, and, you know, all they wanted. But initially, all they wanted to do was to score in front of their home crowd. That was their dream. And after that came the riches. And the setup here, like you said, is there's a lot of private school, there's a lot of really well-educated. Rugby still has that class, as much as people like me would love to think it doesn't, it's still there. So these players that you're talking about, they're on a conveyor belt, aren't they? These kids are still being produced in Tonga and Samoa. It's not that this well is going to dry up. So this need that you're talking about is needed now in this instant, but it's also still going to be needed in the years to come.
Yeah, it is. And that's the thing, you know. I think every every rugby player wants to leave a legacy, wants to leave a jersey that they may have worn in a better position than when they first put it on. And it's about passing that on. And for me, that's exactly, you hit it on the head, Bruce. It's about being able to leave the game in a better place for that next generation so that they don't have to go through some of the, the abuse that, that some of us have had to go through at the hands of our own, some of our own unions. But also, it's just the right thing to do. As you said, the Pacific Islands is, whether we're at the World Cups or not, we're always going to be producing players for this game, and not just any players, some of the world's best players.
Yeah.
You look at the two probably highest. Top three or four players in the world, but Semi Randraja and Charles Pietel are up there. as some of the best players in the world, and you look at the last since rugby went professional in 1995. It's always been the case. You're talking about the top players in the world. You're talking about Joe Nolomu, Wasali Serevi,
Ulimai, he could go on and on and on.
Yep, and that's gonna continue, Bruce. So it's up to us to make sure that we safeguard, that we make sure that these kids, this next generation, and make sure that I think for me, it's making sure that the economics of their situations are being looked after, so that the people that are due. The rewards of helping develop those players are actually seeing that.
You said something in the middle of that answer that I've written down here, and this comes back to the movie, and I've watched it I think three times, and I'll probably watch it again. You said it's the right thing to do. When does Dan get frustrated? Because to me, you're a calm, kind. You try and see the good in people, and you just want the right thing to happen, and the right thing isn't happening, and that's evident to anybody with a set of eyes. When do you get frustrated, or are you able to detach yourself and say, no, I've got a professional job to do here to support people and to put things in place for what moves on?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think no one's ever convinced through anger. We're very, very, very little of the time. So it's important that we keep our cool and just, we just do this in the right way. And that's the Pacific Island way. We go through tough times, and but we do with a smile on our face, even if I remember playing my first test for Samoa, and it was against the Wallabies in 2005. We lost that game 70-7. We came off the field, they were laughing, they were singing, they were having a great time. You would have thought we'd won by 70-5. that's the island way, mate. At the end of the day, it is just the game. I sometimes have to step back and remind myself of that. And there's a lot of people struggling in the world, a lot more than what we're struggling with. With our rugby struggles with Pacific Island rugby. So it's about perspective. But in saying that, we don't just sweep it under the carpet. We want to see, and I ultimately believe that it's for the good of the game. I think that if you look after the small guy well, then everyone benefits. It'll benefit the tier one nations, hands down. It will, and it's about growing that pie, and whatever piece of the pie you've got becomes worth a lot more if you grow that bigger picture. So financially, it makes sense as well to do the right thing. I just can't see the what the resistance. I mean, I know there is resistance, but I don't see the logic behind the resistance some of the time. But when that resistance is out there, sometimes it's just people stuck in their ways. And again, we've got to have grace for those kind of people. Everyone's on the journey. I make mistakes. I made a massive mistake last week. I tweeted something about CJ Stander, career, and I was like, and I got it wrong. But we've got to be willing to apologize, say when we got it wrong, and move forward. You know, no one gets it right all of the time. So we've just got to make sure that, you know, but, you know, we're all pulling in the same direction. And that's the great thing about the rugby community. You know, it's about the values. I do believe that the values of rugby are still there to some extent, but it's up to us, you and me, people that are listening here, to make sure we're protecting those values, to make sure it doesn't just become a sport about the bottom line, you know, how much money is being made. Because if it, you know, if it does, then we've not, you know, it's not those people in the suits that have failed, it's us as the supporters and the lovers and the players of the game who have failed. Because ultimately the people in the suits, you know, in the unions and world rugby, they reflect us, you know, they reflect the people that they represent, which is the smaller clubs, you know, the people that turn out on the sidelines every Saturday and Sunday supporting their kids. We are rugby. It's not them. Yeah.
Dan, I'm in absolute awe and in love. I think if you had a mic, I would let you drop it and just walk off now, and that would be the finish. There's so much in there. I'm not going to convince people with anger. We need to show grace. Right, can we start this now? Dan Leo for World Rugby President? Will we just, this is your launch. Will we just go for it?
Mate, well, I'll tell you what, I don't know if I'm cut out, so I'm just like everyone else sitting out there watching, you know.
Wants to see it
in a, you know, in a strong place, and becoming that world game that we know it can be, you know, and protecting the values, you know, is key to that, mate. And you know, yeah, no, I really appreciate it, Bruce. You know, everyone that's watching, all the support that they've given for the documentary. You know, because we didn't know how it would be received, and it was the first time for me. I didn't have any filmmaking background or anything like that. I was really self-conscious about presenting it, and that sort of stuff. But if you're passionate enough about something, you just got to get on with and do it, you know. And for me, that was something that was very close to my heart, as I know.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It is for you and the audience here. So and I really appreciate everyone's support for that, for Oceans Apart, and what we're trying to achieve there.
Oh, it was awesome. And I was getting messages from people, because they know I'm a rugby fanatic. I was getting messages from people who weren't necessarily rugby fanatics talking about this guy, Dan Leo, and this isn't fair. And it's gone further than just, I think sports people have watched it. I'm not sure. I think maybe the timing was good because people were looking for stuff to watch and this came up. So I think it was awesome. It was so good. And that point, I'm going to pick up on that one, because that's a word I love, is passion. Now, you don't have to do this stuff. You're doing this because you're passionate about it and you want to make the world a better place. Have you found it easy to get people to jump on your bandwagon?
I think I wouldn't say easy. I think taking and maintaining the moral high ground is really important. And just, you know, when something's so obviously right or wrong, it's easy, and you've just got to make sure that you're aligned with that. Again, you know, it comes down to saying things and challenging things when things do need to be challenged. Doing that in the right way, with humility, respect. I think definitely when it came to, you know, confronting, you know, people like our Prime Minister in Samoa. I know, as you said, Bruce, you know, people, you know, and, you know, you see it all the time with presenters, you know, probably more experienced presenters would have pushed a little bit harder on people like Brett Gosper and stuff and really held them to task. For me, it was just about just asking the questions and allowing them to give their point of view without me trying to put them into a box and say something that they didn't necessarily want to say. For me, that's the biggest thing, you know, those aspects, and hopefully allowing, you know, the good in people to shine through, which again, as I said, you know, I think it's in all of us. You know, and yeah, let's really push forward. Let's focus on the positives, because there's a lot of positives to take out of where the game is at the moment as well. And I know it's going through a lot of tough, you know, with COVID, with the concussion, with, you know, the Women's World Cup being cancelled. There's a lot of there's a lot of things that can probably get you down around the sport. But there's a lot of to be positive about as well, and for me, it comes back to those values and those the thing I've always loved is you know, that just getting out there at whatever level it is, you know. And that was why I played on for as long as I did. Went right down the levels, right down to London 3 Southwest, I think we were playing at London Cornish at one stage. But it's just about, you know, getting in the clubhouse. Not even about the results, just about getting there, you know, and sharing those experiences with your teammates and having that camaraderie. It's so important. And you know, at the essence of everything, if you take away all the money, take away all the, you know, all the fans. Well, we've seen all the fans have been taken away this year anyway. But you take away all the glitz and glamour of professional rugby. Rugby will always survive because there's good people that play it. That gives me hope. That's what, you know, I know because I've been there, you know, the 99% of people that I meet in the rugby world want to see the Pacific Islands thrive. They want to see us achieve, achieve greatness and achieve our potential, I suppose. So I know that's how people feel. So in that respect, it was really easy. It was just about giving them, raising awareness and giving them something to get behind, which I've done in droves. So again, I'm really, really thankful.
I just love it, Dan. I absolutely love it. And talking about going down the leagues, I mean, you've just said we got hammered by the Wallabies, but we were smiling and we'd been able to play and we were together. I don't know if you use things like band of brothers or family or all of that stuff, but that's what it was. The same with London Cornish. Now, I'm trying to picture what it must have been like playing against London Cornish, and Dan Leo gets out his car and takes his kit bag out his boot, and I'm standing as a fly half thinking, oh no.
Well, I'll tell you what, it wasn't as bad as you think. Yeah, I'm actually, if anything, I was the one that was coming, because the problem is when you step down to the amateur leagues as an ex-professional, you've just got a target on your chest, and everybody that wants to make a name for themselves, you know, every time I got the ball, I had four or five guys on me. So I learned how to distribute. I learned how to pass over the top and throw the skip pass and everything, because I had to, because I was just, yeah, I was getting hammered, and you can't win, you know, you can't win playing, you know. It's like, you know, if you play well, everyone goes, well, okay, yeah, but he's an ex-professional. Of course he's going to play well. If you play badly, everyone's like, well, hold on, he's an ex-professional. Why is he playing badly? Like, so, yeah.
You could just imagine so many people dining out on that one. You'll never guess who we beat today. And you know who they had playing for them? Yeah, Dan Leo. Yeah, yeah. But we, I can imagine, I could just imagine those stories getting bigger as the night went on. So you came across and you mentioned about playing for Wasps and playing in France. When you came across, who did you look at and think, I'm sharing a changing room with this guy, or what planet is that guy on, or I'm playing against this guy and I've only ever were there any moments where you went back to being just little Dan, a bit starstruck in that environment?
It's funny, hey, when I came across the Wasps, I don't really know anyone. I knew the guys that have been, so I think that's one of the back then it was one of the best the things that Super Rugby did well. They just really, you just got basically bombarded with propaganda saying that there was no other competition in the world apart from Super Rugby. So I knew all the Super Rugby teams and stuff, but I knew very little about the English Premiership or the Six Nations or the top 14 in France. I knew three names on the Wasps side, and that was only because they'd been in the 2003 England team. And it was Delalio, Matt Dawson, and Josh Lucy. Those are the only names I recognised when I turned up to Wasps. And Simon Shaw, four. So I was a bit starstruck by those guys. But then I got there and there were some players there that were absolutely fantastic. And I had to look them up. I had to go home and Google them and go, this guy played out of his skin today. Like, who's he? Oh, Google. Oh, Rafael Ibanez has only been the French captain for the last, seven or eight years. been at four World Cups. Paul Sackey, guys like, Alex King, young guys like Danny Cipriani and James Haskell. It was just an amazing time to come through with guys that went on, if they weren't already sort of, rugby superstars, like they went on to be. And looking back now, and being in that sort of setup and just walking into it basically with no reputation myself and winning the Heineken Cup, I took it for granted because I turned up in 2005. Straight away, within 3 weeks of being there, we'd won the Powergen Cup. The next year, we won the Premiership, and then the next year after that, we won the Heineken Cup. I just thought, just these kind of competitions, they're easy to win, And then it wasn't until, and then I went for 10 years on, and I didn't win anything, and I thought, flip, actually, what a time to be at Wasps, so it was an amazing time. Got some really fond memories. Good to see them coming back as well, Wasps. Went through some dark places. I do follow them. If anything, I probably, because they were the first club, I went on to play at Bordeaux for a couple of seasons, Perpignan and London Irish at the end of my career. Wasps really hold a special place in my memory in terms of just because of what we were able to achieve over that period of time. So, yeah, great memories.
It's an amazing thing when young guys win early. Is it wasted on them because they're too young, or do they get used to it? When do you appreciate it? But as we all know, the youth is wasted on the young, isn't it? I mean, it's
massively, hugely. I think, I still keep in touch with Danny Cipriani now. But we look back, and he's similar. To go, to have that high the very early on in your career, to come at the, being at the end of your career, you look back and you think, geez, I probably did take a little bit for granted. I've got no regrets on that front. I was really lucky to be there. I wasn't, as I said, I was probably, I think for me it was, I was used as a bit of a stopgap to fill in between a bit of the old guard and the new guard coming through. We had some guys like Delalio and Joe Worsley that were there when I first arrived, and there was a younger generation, James Haskell and Tom Rees, guys like that, and they needed someone to sort of just shepherd those guys through. And I was lucky enough that they picked me. I don't know why they did. It was probably just because I was available. As I said, I played in that game for Samoa. I wasn't eligible to play in Australia anymore. So much about rugby at the top level is about luck and being in the right place at the right time, and just not being injured. I think that was probably my biggest strength through my career. I wasn't ever the best player, but I just never got injured. I had no operation. Yeah, I've had two operations in the last 6 months. One, I had a tooth implant, and then I had a vasectomy. No more kids for me. And that was. And I said to my wife, "I've just had two operations. I didn't have any operations in the last 15 years." So much of it's luck, and you've got to be very, very lucky to make it as a top athlete these days. Because I've seen so many players with a lot more talent with me than me coming through, but they've been just haven't been resilient in terms of physically, they've just been unlucky with injuries, or mentally, so you got to, or you just don't get spotted. I was lucky to have a couple of good games right at the start of my career, when right when the Queensland Reds selectors, you know, the two good games that I had that season, they were the selectors were there. I was rubbish for the rest of the season.
I don't believe that for a second.
I went on to become an international rugby player based on, you know, having two good games at the right time. So, I can't claim to be the hardest worker. You know, I was never the strongest in the gym, never the best player. But, you know, I consider myself very, very, very blessed to be in the, you know, to be talking with you now and, you know, having these conversations.
So, Dan, what was the difference in culture between Super Rugby and then jump into the Premiership? Because we look from here often, you mentioned rose-tinted specs before. There's a feeling that Super Rugby, from this angle, from the Northern Hemisphere, is it's basketball, it's not real rugby. And then there are other people who look at it and go, that's what rugby should be like. So what was it like jumping from that to Premiership rugby that was probably quite a different task?
Yeah, I didn't play too much Super Rugby, if I'll be honest. I had one season contracted with the Reds, but, you know, definitely the thing that really sort of took me off guard was just the focus around the set piece. I felt like, you know, I've been a line-out forward in Australia for a few years, and then I came to England, I felt like I didn't know anything about line-outs. Mauling, definitely mauling, and, you know, just around, you know, the scrums, the emphasis that went into those, the finer details of the game, you know. We spent every spare moment of time, and when I was at the Reds, on fitness, it was all heart monitored, tracking, and that became more prevalent in the Premiership the longer I was in it. But when I first arrived, it was literally just big guys running at each other. And it was so much more physical than anything that I'd been that I was used to, but that has changed, I think. I was probably quite lucky in a way that when I came, I think the profile that I had when I arrived was good for the Premiership then. But now I wouldn't, you know, I'd struggle to play any games, not just because of the changes to the laws, but also second row forwards, back row forwards are expected to do so much more now. You know, and you look at the physiques of these guys like Maro Itoje. You know, they could be equally comfortable as bodybuilders, you know, or boxers. I look at Maro Itoje and I think, you know, he's not far off, you know, heavyweight champion of the world material, you know, in terms of his physique. And Anthony Joshua would be proud, you know. So, you know, I was never that mould, and probably, for me, I was probably one of the last guys who played amateur rugby, and then played professional as well. A lot of the guys that come through now have just been professionals all their lives, come through academies. I went into professional rugby quite late. My first professional contract was at the age of 21. So I'd played that amateur game and had all of those experiences, which you sort of, it's not for these guys now because they've missed out on a lot, you know. But with that, I think I had an appreciation for those, you know, for the off field, and just finding your opposition and having a beer with them and all those kind of things were really important to me, which probably nowadays I know they've replaced that in a lot of instances, you know, you've got media commitments straight after games, drinking's frowned upon, you know, pubs are closed anyway, so even if you wanted to go out for a beer, then you couldn't. So the game's changed. I don't know if it's for the better in a lot of instances, but, you know, again, you know, that's why I loved going back down and playing amateur at the end of my career. I started off playing amateur rugby and I wanted to finish off, and those are probably the best memories for me, you know. As I said earlier, you know, those social moments as opposed to, you know, we had some great moments on the field, obviously, but off the field, mate, you couldn't replicate them.
and that's the thing people miss. Is that what you miss about the game? Is the, you know, whenever you hear a retired player and they're asked, what is it you miss? They never say scoring the try or making the pass or jackaling or any of that. They say, I missed the changing room. Yeah, that's the place I miss.
Exactly, and it's so true. It's so true, and you know, for me, you know, it was all about that. You know, just and to see guys now so focused now, and you know, it can become too much about the results. With my kids now, you know, and they're just starting to pick up rugby balls and all that sort of stuff. I want them to enjoy it first and foremost. You know, and rugby's so great for that, because you know you can be the best player on the field, and I've seen it time and time again. You can be the ultimate star on the field, but off the field, unless you're a good bloke, you know, you're not going to get any respect from anyone, you know, and that's how teams are judged, you know. It's, and I've you know, I just finished reading James Haskell's book, and he said a lot better than I did. But you know, that's the great thing about rugby, is you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if you're the star or not, you know, but you've got, everyone's got a value to play, everyone's got a role to play in a team. You can be the worst player.
The chapter I'm on of the James Haskell is he's the one that drinks the beer, he's the one that dresses up, he's the one that, that's the chapter I'm on. So yeah, I know what James Haskell's getting at. So those changes.
I'm just glad I got off pretty easy on that book.
I was about to say, I don't remember your name coming up.
Yeah, at one stage I was thinking, oh, geez, he's not going to tell that story again. Thank God he didn't.
So those changing rooms that you're in, that's the bit. I don't want a fly on the wall. I don't want to see into the changing room, but I would love to be in the changing room, because it should be for the players and the coaches and the physios and the it should be for them. I don't really like getting the glimpse into the changing room, but I always wish I was there, because it is the bit I loved. What's a Samoa changing room like?
Oh, geez. Pretty different. Samoa changing room is pretty different. Yeah. For one, I remember my first tour with Samoa, and Brian Lima was sort of the patron, the oldest, most senior player on the side, and he had a real bugbear about people wearing headphones, and that was sort of the big thing. You know, my generation was, you know, we were like, you know, we'd seen Jonah Lomu doing it. Everyone was like, oh, if Jonah Lomu walks in with the big headphones on, I want to be like that guy. And so, you know, particularly us from, you know, that had been raised in New Zealand, we got to Samoa, and like, he was like, hold on here. What's this? You know, if you're wearing headphones, it means you don't want to, and particularly he had those worst ones on the bus. If you wore your earphones on the bus, he had a real problem with that. And I just remember him, thank God it wasn't me, but I remember him and just telling the bus driver, he sent a message up to the bus, and the bus has just stopped. And we're like, oh, what's going here? We're not back at our hotel yet. We're not at the training ground. Like, what's happening? And then he basically just, he had seen someone wearing headphones on the bus, and he called them to the back of the bus, and he goes, oh, what's your problem? Do you not want to talk to the player that's sitting next to you, don't you? You think you're too good for him? The guy was like, oh no, this is just how I prepare, you know. And Brian made him goes, okay, well, if the song's so good, and you think it's and you're enjoying it so much, can you share it with all of us? So basically made him walk up and down the aisle on the bus singing the song up loud. But normally that would be that, you know, under normal circumstances in a normal team, everyone would be cracking up and laughing and taking the mickey out of this guy. Everyone was deadpan. Everyone was scared. I'm not going to say it, but skip. So no one was laughing. It was like the most weird, bizarre atmosphere ever. So this guy was walking up and down the aisle singing this, I think it was like a Tupac rap song. So he was rapping along to it. No one was laughing. No, everyone was just looking down at their feet. Just like, it was just really, really awkward. But no one ever wore headphones on the bus again, and we just, you know, and actually we started singing songs, Samoan songs, and for me it was really great. I started to love it, because, you know, I learned some of the language. We were only allowed to speak Samoan on the bus, and I didn't really know how to speak Samoan, so I had to learn pretty quickly. I was crapping myself the whole time, not wanting to get on the wrong side of Brian, not really knowing what was allowed, what wasn't. But yeah, so it was pretty different. Pretty different, Bruce. I don't know if it's like that anymore. When I became a senior, it was borderline. Some of the treatment from the senior players towards the younger players was probably borderline bullying. Back then, this is the early 2000s, and by the time I became a senior player myself, and guys like Census Johnston and Khan Fotuoli'i, Joe Tokori, we didn't want to have that culture. We wanted it to be a bit more abrasive. We realized by that stage that the best performing teams got the best out of the young players and actually valued those young players as opposed to just, you know, treating them like shit, which is. Seem to be that sort of back of the bus mentality from, you know, probably in all of rugby back in the 80s, whereas we were still doing it at Samoa in the early 2000s. We hadn't moved on with the times. So it was important for us as senior players when we got our chance to really let that go and just sort of, you know, move things on a bit. So, Samoa was pretty different, mate.
Did the boys like to sing together?
We did. Well, that was what we were doing the whole time. So there was no Walkmans, no Discmans back those days on the bus. So all we could do was sing. And we didn't have money to go to the movies or do any social events. So, you know, we'd just sing. And that was what we did good. Just all church songs that most of us, you know, that most of the boys knew. And if you didn't know, you sat next to a local. They'd put you in a roommate situation with one of the New Zealand raised guys, with one of the locally raised guys, and basically your job was just to learn as much as you could off those local players, because and they were learning, you know, whereas we were trying to bring them up to speed, some of those local players, on a rugby sense in terms of our experience that we had in trying to, you know, they didn't have any professional background, so we were trying to help them out. They were helping us out with the culture and actually helping us to root ourselves back in the Samoan culture, which a lot of us had lost being raised in New Zealand and Australia. So it was sort of a bit of give and take, brilliant times. You know, we went to Samoa and we did a 1 week camp on a desert island, and it was called the Back to Your Roots camp. And basically they released about 10 pigs onto the island, and we were in groups of four, and they gave us about six or seven machetes, one per group, and they were like, there you go, you got to survive for a week, go and find water, we know there's not enough food on this island because we've just released 10 pigs. Now you guys are on your own, and I'll tell you what, that was a real eye opener for me. You know, like having to hunt out. I've never seen anything die in my life, and then come, you know, having to slit a pig's throat. You know, you probably wouldn't be allowed to do it in the UK, you know, because of health and safety and RSPCA and stuff like that. But in the islands, anything goes. You know, and it was almost like a bad version of Lord of the Flies at times, but it brought us together, and it did the job. You know, I think that year we beat the Wallabies, you know, and my first test was losing to the Wallabies by 70 points to 5, and 4 or 5 years later we turned around in 2011, just before the World Cup, and we beat them. So that was awesome to see that happen. With very little resources as well.
Everybody loves Fiji, Tonga, Samoa. They're everybody's second team. When you watch the World Cup and it's not your team playing, you're willing the Pacific Islands to do well. What was it like when they came together as the Pacific Islanders for that tour that you were on?
That one was really weird. It was really weird. It was sort of just because we all came together. It was very difficult because, as I said earlier, Bruce, you know, we are very close in proximity, but our cultures are quite different as well. And our history, there's a lot of inter-tribal, inter-island warfare between our nations. You know, Samoa's been occupied both by Fiji and Tonga at various points in our history. So to try and come in and lay aside all of those issues, knowing that you've got a test batch, so you have to perform it in 3 days, 3 days' time, is really, really, really difficult. You know, I think if I'll be honest, I don't think a lot of us probably gave it the respect, looking back, that it deserved. I think we could have been a lot better. I think a lot of us sort of saw it as a bit of a break from our contracts, with our club contracts, because, you know, we weren't playing for Samoa, we weren't playing for Fiji. There was a lot of drinking, a lot of partying. But some great, you know, for me, as again, I was quite young. It was 2006 when I first went on there. I'd only been in, I was playing with guys like Rupini Thauthau Nibutha, Simon Raualui, Alisana Tui, like some of the, you know, big names, guys that I really looked up to. That was probably the highlight for me. It was probably, Bruce probably falls into that bracket that I was speaking about earlier, you know, one of those ones you look back and you think, flip, you know, I don't know what I had until it's gone. Yeah. And I think if a lot of us had the opportunity again, we probably would have taken it a lot more seriously, especially knowing what we know now, and that the team is not in existence and a lot of people are fighting to see a resurgence, to see it come back. Let's just hope that when it comes back, it's given, you know, and that was probably, and I think that mentality that we had as players was probably dictated from higher up. You know, it wasn't very well funded. The preparation time wasn't great. And definitely my club saw it as that. My club really didn't. The second tour in 2009 that I was selected for the Pacific Islanders, WASP actually asked me not to go because I said, look, we know what the last tour was like. If it was you going to play for Samoa, we would let you go. We definitely wouldn't put any blocks, but it's the Pacific Islanders. It's a bit of a Mickey Mouse test series. Would you mind staying? They'd lost, Tom Palmer and Simon Shaw to England at the time as well. So they wanted a bit more second row stocks around. So I could sort of understand where they were coming from. But that's why it's key that when we do those tours, if we get another opportunity to do that, they're financed well, they're properly prepared so that the players come and see that and they think, actually, this is something that we can actually turn up and beat England. It's not just us turning up as cannon fodder, which is sort of, we got the feel that we were sort of being set up back in that one, definitely in 2006 and 2009. So, yeah.
Those are things that players like to aspire to, though, aren't they? Obviously, you want to play for your national team and represent your country, but those other opportunities, whether it's the Barbarians or Pacific Islanders or North v South or whatever it is, it's a big lift to your spirit to be asked to be involved in those things. Do you think there is a chance that that could come back?
I like to think so. I'd really like to see it happen. And even if it wasn't to play tests, I think it would be a great opportunity to put together a Pacific Island 15 made up of Premiership players or European-based players to play invitational sides. Maybe I've been reached out to by various clubs over the last 6 months who have said that they'd happily host us and allow us to use their stadiums for nothing. So I think, there's a lot of goodwill out there and a lot of people would love to see that, a Pacific Islanders side against a Gloucester or against an Edinburgh, make it a three-match tour, alongside, some of the tests that are being played maybe in June down in the Pacific Nations Cup. So I think there's a lot of potential. I think we need to look at it slightly differently than what the format was last time. And also we've got a little bit of work to do in terms of who would actually run that, because what was one of the downfalls of the last Pacific Islands was that the island unions themselves just didn't get on. And I remember at the time in 2006, I think Samoa we were providing 14 out of the 32 players selected. So they said, well, if we're providing half of the players, we should be getting half of the finances that this team's generated. And, it all became about, it just went all a bit sour and a bit pear-shaped. So there needs to be proper thought around that before they can bring it back. But, I'd love to see it back, and I'm willing to help drive it if that's something that people would like to see as well.
Those are the things mere mortals like me and people listening have no idea about, that we just want to see that team play, but the logistics and the money and the funding and this, it's just all stuff that somebody else is taking care of. We just want to see the product, but I think we're beginning to learn more and more, certainly through the work you're doing. So now, and I've kept you for so long, but I have to ask, there's the chance of two teams being based in the Pacific Islands. I always worry when I hear the word franchise, because it makes me wonder who's in charge and who's running it. So what's your view on that? Is that a positive step forward?
I think it certainly can be. Like you, I've got lots of question marks, particularly around the second team. So one of the proposed sides is in Fiji. I think that'll work wonderfully. I think they've got the infrastructure there, they've got facilities, they've got the population to make it really work, and they've got a track record. You know, Super Rugby games have been hosted in Fiji and done really well, both in terms of crowd numbers and economically in terms of what that's generated into the financially for the community there. The Moana Pacifica bid, which is the combined side, what I believe, from what I understand, it'll be a side made up of Tongans and Samoans, but based in New Zealand. I've got a few question marks around that one. I want to know how it's set to benefit, if it's going to be based in Auckland. I think we need some assurances around how that's going to benefit the islands, how many games are going to be played there, what the organisational structure is going to be, where the finances are going to be, are going to go, where, whether they're going to get a fair share of the money generated in terms of broadcast revenue. All of those questions need to be answered. For me, any side that's going to be a Pacific Island side needs to be based in the Pacific. We can't allow it to become, a fifth or a sixth New Zealand rugby franchise. That would be, in my terms, detrimental to the cause that we're being fighting for. For me, it's got to be something that's positioned in the Pacific Islands and actually with assistance from World Rugby and possibly New Zealand Rugby, run by Pacific Islands as well. So we need our administrators in there, in those top positions, learning the trade alongside somebody, maybe for 3 or 4 years, until they get to the position where they have the skill set to be able to run that independently. But until those assurances come through, I'm not getting too excited. But definitely the Fiji bit, I think they're ready to fire. And let's hope it goes. I think it's really positive and good to see that World Rugby have, probably, albeit being dragged kicking and screaming to the to the table, have finally seen it within their hearts to invest into those sides as well. It's only taken 20 or 25 years of professional rugby for us to get to this point.
Yeah, I think it's for anybody that loves the game, we want this to work. We don't want it to be a 2-year project and then it leaves a bigger hole than was there before. And again, I come back to, I don't know politics, I don't understand politics, I just want it to be right for those people. How important is somebody like Ben Ryan for the cause of Pacific Island rugby?
He's been a great advocate, and continues to be a great, he's a great thinker on the game and someone that's just got so much experience in terms of our mentalities that we have as well. Definitely in Fiji, he's got a lot of respect there, a lot of mana, we say, and we need, and he's outspoken on the issues. He'll call a spade, and that's probably what we've been lacking is, people that are knowledgeable, A, and B, willing to call things out when they need to be called out. So, like Ben and many of us others, hopefully, with more voices like that being vocal, it'll inspire others to speak out as well and really add to the momentum that's starting to build now in terms of really seeing the Pacific Islands get a fair crack of the whip, I suppose, and that level playing field that we've needed and wanted for so long.
Yeah, Dan, I've absolutely loved it. I've kept you longer than I told you I was going to keep you. I could go on, but it's probably your bedtime now in Brisbane. I ask people this question to finish this sentence, and I'm really intrigued what Dan Leo is gonna hit me with here, because you've spoken a lot about happiness and positivity and seeing good in people. So at the end of the pod, I ask people to finish the sentence, happiness is. So, Dan Leo, for you, happiness is?
For me, happiness is fulfilling your potential and doing that with on an even playing field. And I think that's I think they're intertwined. I think everyone can attribute to that. So if we're attributing to an even playing field, we will see people fulfill their potential. And fulfilling potential is anything, mate. You know, it's on and off the rugby field. You know, probably more important off the field than on the field. But rugby teaches us some of those great lessons. In both. So yeah, good question.
Dan, I absolutely love it. I can say thank you, but I mean it much, much deeper than that. I've absolutely loved speaking to you. Thank you for taking the time out. I think I'm going to absolutely stick you in here and say you need to come back for part two, because I've absolutely loved it. I think you're a real role model who speaks with that calm, cool sense that we need to get on the back of and support, and I hope anybody that's listening has felt that warmth and humble attitude that you've got, but can see a gritty determination to make the world a better place, and hopefully we're all going to jump on that and support you. So thank you very, very much. All the best to you, and I hope the next 6 months gives you everything that you need it to give, and the world opens up, and you and the family stay safe and healthy.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. And I really appreciate it, guys. It's great to see this pod up and running, and we wish you all the best for the future. Look forward to listening to up-and-coming guests as well. So really appreciate everyone that's listened. And cheers, guys.
Thank you, Dan. Magic. Absolutely brilliant. I am a very happy boy. To me, happiness at the moment is Dan Leo. What an absolute superstar. Very humble. Puts himself down, as we're beginning to learn lots of the best people seem to do. Talks about being grounded. Wanted to build relationships, share experiences, and make memories. Where have we heard that before? Beginning to sound like a broken record. I am almost speechless because he has taken words right out of my mouth. I absolutely loved it. If you enjoyed it, you can catch us on Apple, Acast, and Spotify. Please subscribe. And if you've enjoyed it, please leave a review. If you didn't enjoy it, then remember that if you've got nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all. Hopefully you did, and you'll be back soon for more of Happiness is Egg-Shaped with me, your host, Bruce Aitchison. All the best, stay safe, and stay healthy. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Mayhem.
Hello, I'm Chaos.
And our happiness is egg-shaped.
Happiness is egg-shaped. It loves a circle with no end.
Oh, what? What's that about this last night? And he said, happiness is egg-shaped.
Hey, happiness is egg-shaped.
Happiness is egg-shaped. It loves a circle with no end.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.